afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
We have two guests in studio today. Professor David G. Schwartz, who is a director of the gaming... I'll try that again. He's a director of the Center for Gaming Research at UNLV, talking about his new book, Tales from the Pit. We also have Anthony Curtis, publisher of Huntington Press and the Las Vegas Advisor. David Schwartz and Anthony Curtis, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Before we get to David and Anthony, I've had an email concerning the software Video Poker for Winners on Windows 10. Current release, 1.78, works just fine with Windows 10. Each purchase of Video Poker for Winners allows you to download the software on up to two machines. After two, it'll cost you $10 each time you wish to transfer the software license to another device. If you wish to download another copy, whether it's the free one or one for $10, go to videopokerforwinners.com and click on the support button at the bottom. Let's talk about Tales from the Pit. This book was a written compilation of an oral history. So, David Schwartz, how did it come about, and what were the goals of the project?
Well, what happened is I thought that it would be a good idea to document what people who actually ran gaming thought of gaming in Las Vegas, especially as it's changed so much over the past 40 years. So I got a grant from the UNLV University Libraries Advisory Board and was able to go out and interview about 20 former and current Pit managers and above, and that's really where the book came from.
All right. Now, in general, we're comparing Las Vegas to 40 years ago and today and all the time in between. 40 years ago was the end of the mob era, basically, and then it got into big corporations. So how's that made a difference?
Well, there's been a lot of changes. Probably the biggest one is that there's been a loss of autonomy on the casino floor, where before, whoever was running the casino basically ran the entire hotel. Now they're just one department in a very big organization. You know, probably the other big change that they noticed was when the IRS came to town and really started cracking down. And that is what drove a lot of them out of the ranks of dealing and into the ranks of management, because as managers, they didn't have the tip income that dealers did.
Yeah, so I started dealing in 1978, and most dealers did not want to go on the floor because it was a cut in pay, a pretty substantial cut in pay. And you know, at that time, people didn't declare any tip income at all. In 1981, the IRS came in and said, unless you start declaring 100% of your tips, if you declare 100% of your tips starting in 1982, then whatever you earned prior to that will give you amnesty. So you're free as long as you start declaring January 1st, 82. So at that time, I called the IRS and I said, what if I only work, you know, for a couple of months in 82? And they said, well, as long as you declare everything you make, then you'll still have amnesty for everything before. So that's what I did. I declared more than what I was actually making in tips, and I worked for 6 weeks, and then I quit the job. At that time, I was also playing blackjack and making more money playing blackjack than I was dealing it anyway, so it was time for me to move on. But that definitely spurred that decision. But then a year later, I did get an audit notice, and I called them up and said, hey, we had this deal that, you know, I was supposed to have amnesty. And they said, well, you didn't declare everything you made in 82. You only declared you made $6,000. And I said, but I only worked 6 weeks. And then they said, oh, okay, well, then you're fine.
And but everybody took the deal, and nobody declared everything after that anyway.
Well, but I did have friends who greatly under-declared, yeah. And many of them got audited and had came up with really big bills, $10,000, $20,000 that they had to pay. They thought they were going to be able to get away with it, and many, many people did not get away with it, at least people that I was dealing with. One of the things I liked about the book was in the introduction, you quote Bill Friedman, and he is the guy I worked for, and Vic Tosser, who was a dealer with me. We dealt craps together. I think Bill Friedman, well, first of all, he was running two casinos at the same time back then, which, I mean, I can't imagine happening today. As you say, including the hotel and everything else. He had both the Castaways and the Silver Slipper, and he asked Summa Corporation, which was Howard Hughes Corporation, to also take over the Landmark, and they just thought that it wouldn't be possible for him to handle three casinos at the same time.
Okay. Employee theft has always been there. Part of every supervisor's job in a casino is to check to see employees aren't stealing. Today, borrowing Dan Rather's title, the camera never blinks. If an employee is suspected of stealing, surveillance can go over and over and over the tapes of that employee working weeks after the fact. In the old days, if it wasn't caught on the fly, it wasn't going to be caught. Now, maybe you can get caught later. On the flip side, if you were caught stealing from one casino 30 years ago, you could get another job across the street. Today, not so much, because very few corporations control most of the casinos. What was your overall takeaway on this subject, David Schwartz?
Yeah, you know, that was definitely a big part of their job. They're looking for cheating from players, but mostly they're looking at employees, and it seems that most of the problems in the casinos would come from the dealers either not doing their job well or deliberately trying to steal. And there's also a culture where everybody was kind of taking a little, so dealers weren't supposed to hustle, but they would hustle, and they'd take care of their box, and it would be okay. So kind of everybody would get a cut everywhere, and that really started to change once you had the corporate influence come in. And they said, no, we're going to emphasize customer service over everything else. That seemed to change a lot.
But, see, I don't see that at all. I don't, you know, you say the emphasis on customer service. I think the customer service is just horrible in Las Vegas. And actually, I was talking to my son just the other day, and we were talking about millennials and how millennials don't like to gamble. And A, they don't like slot machines because they're used to Xbox and PlayStation, and to watch reels spin around is ludicrous to them. And my son said to me, well, the reason we don't want to play table games is because if you don't know how to play the game, the dealers are such assholes. And I said, really? I mean, the dealers won't help you? And he's like, no, they're really rude for the most part. And actually, you know, I thought I was jaded because I run into rude dealers all the time. But no, I think at least the young people are finding the same thing. And I said, what about the party pits, you know, where it's the girls that are there? I would think they would be more service-oriented. And he said, that is a little better, but the players are often nasty. You know, you go up and they ask, do you want insurance? And you don't know what that means. And then all the players are like, just don't take it. Just don't take it. You know what I mean? So it's not a pleasant experience.
Well, it was a weird trade-off back then when there was more table for table. People could keep their own, and the dealers would. The customer service was built in because the more the customers liked them, the more they would toke. The other side of that sword was that some of them would do what they would call strong-arm hustling. I mean, they would literally almost take money out of your, well, they would. They would take money off your stack and put it up and say, this one's for the boys at the crap table, or this one's for the dealer. So, you know, you got both that way.
Yeah, no, that absolutely went on. And still does in the places. There are still a few places around the country where the dealers get to keep their own tokes. And they're strong-arming.
But they are also friendlier overall. I mean, you don't see that many sourpusses because they go home with nothing. I mean, you still see it. I ask. I go, really? This is a table-for-table joint, and this person is so sullen. And they're like, yeah, the guy's just he's a grapefruit. It's the way he is, you know?
We started talking about dealer cheating, and now we're talking about dealer hustling for tips.
Oh, I want to say something about the cheating as well. I mean, so at the place I worked, first of all, there were no cameras. There were cameras, but most of the time they didn't even work in many of these places. And in my joint, when they were there literally was a catwalk, and they would go walk on the catwalk and have binoculars that they could look down at the tables to see what people were doing. And in our place, you would see the dust coming down from the ceiling when they were walking on the catwalk, so everyone knew when they were in the eye.
Yes, they should get skinnier cats.
Yeah. Yes, there are all these better equipment. I don't know that they actually catch any more cheating than they did before. They may catch less because I think the bosses were so much sharper back then. You know, they knew what to look for, and they knew when a dealer looked suspicious or whatever. I heard more than one story of bosses, you know, sidling up to dealers and saying, you know, I'm in. You know, it wasn't you're busted. It was I'm in. I get a cut. Yeah. So
they used to call that cutting in. I mean, the boss would cut in. I mean, if you read one of the books we just put out, I'll heist your book now. But I mean, you know, one that we just put out, which was Cheating at Blackjack. And there's a lot of talk about that, about the bosses cutting into your play. They would know what you were doing. They'd walk up and they got, you've got two choices here. Either I'm in or you're out.
Right, right. And actually, I have a friend who, his uncle was in surveillance at a joint in Lake Tahoe and saw a guy doing something, had no idea what the guy was doing, and he waited for the guy to go to the bathroom. The guy came down out of surveillance, went up to the urinal next to him, and said, I have no idea what you're doing, but I'm in.
Yeah.
You know?
Perfect.
So, yeah.
True blue. I know. I've heard those stories, too. It's true.
David Schwartz, you asked your panel what they would recommend for table game dealers just coming up. And about half of them said they would recommend these people find another career path. Did that surprise you?
Not really, because like I said before, there's been the loss of so much autonomy. It used to be that dealing, you were really the elite if you were a dealer in Vegas, and especially if you were a dealer on the Strip. You'd have to pay your dues downtown for a long time. By the time you made it to the Strip, you're making really good money. Everybody respected you. You'd have a ton of cash every day if you're table for table. And, you know, you go to your local bar, you're tipping them a lot, you're a big, you know, almost a celebrity if you're a dealer. And I think most of that is gone. You have people breaking in on the Strip now, which never would have happened. You know, people breaking in at Caesar's Palace, which wouldn't have happened in a million years.
Well, they closed the Western.
Yeah. I think that's still pretty rare, unless you have juice to break in at Caesar's. That's still a pretty hard job to get. But
what if you're good looking and...
In the party pit, you're right. You're right. You could start at the party pit.
Or go to the D or Golden Gate, and you can skip the smaller places downtown, right?
I got lucky. I broke in at the Golden Nugget, which was by far the best joint downtown at that time. Steve Wynn owned it. And, you know, I just had a boss who sort of took pity on me because I finished dealer school in October. And back then, Vegas was dead. Between Thanksgiving and Christmas, you could fire a cannon in a casino and not hit anybody. And I would go in every other day, and I would go up to this boss and ask him if I could audition. And finally, he's like, all right, yeah, you can audition. Right? He just got tired of seeing me, and I auditioned. And and then he said, all right, you know, I'll let you know if we have anything. And I would come back every other day. And finally he said, look, it's dead in here. There's no way I can hire you. If you come back after the first of the year, I'll give you a job. So that's how I got a job. And I was definitely lucky to start at the Golden Nugget.
Millennials should take note of that. That's called persistence and trying to get hired. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think the other thing, too, is that there used to be a much clearer path upward if you started as a dealer where you could move up more, and I think now they're seeing that as closing a little bit. There's not quite as much room for you to go. So I think that's why some of them were disillusioned. Most of the ones who did suggest going into it, though, said you would have to learn something else too, like marketing or statistics and numbers and stuff like that.
Just
knowing
the
games.
If you
want to
move
up, yeah. No, just knowing the games is enough. But, you know, there's a feeling that being a dealer is not going to be a very good career if that's what you want to do for the next 30 or 40 years.
But on the other hand, it's one of the few jobs that you can go into with no skills and no education and come here and get a job that pays $50,000 a year. You know, I mean, yeah, I don't think there are a lot of people that are cut out to do it because you're dealing with the public, you're dealing with them at their worst, they're drinking, they're losing their money. It can be a rotten job, they're blowing smoke in your face, you know. But for the people who can handle it, it's not a bad way to go.
And for some people, there's something extra on the side. There's just such a, back then and now, it hasn't changed. There's such a fraternity among dealers and bartenders. It's unbelievable. They all over-toke one another. They go from place to place and toke too much, but they get treated like royalty, and they love one another. And I mean, it is a special fraternity that a lot of them are really into being a part of.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Actually, you know, the people that I dealt with 35 years ago are still having reunions from that casino from back then. So, yeah, it's definitely a fraternity.
Well, that's kind of what this book was about, in a way. I mean, as you know, as I read it, it was like a reunion of these guys who all work together. I mean, I'm going to jump right in here. I'm going to give a plug for this book. I didn't publish it, so, you know, it's, usually I'm telling you how great everything is that I published. I did not publish this book, and I'm telling you, it's a great read, and you've got some real characters in here. It's I hope David doesn't take this wrong, but it's probably the greatest bathroom reading book of all time because you can pick it up and lay it down at any time and pick it up again. Some of the guys.
Somebody
that
once told me that about Sex, Lies, and Video Poker.
Yeah, for other reasons. But I mean, I know Jimmy Wyke. I mean, he was one of the guys. I published Bill Zender, but Ron Sacavino I probably knew the best. And Ron was such a character and still is. And Ron comes through loud and clear in this book. Anybody who wants to get a feel for what it was like and how crazy these guys were and the fun they used to have, that's in this book. There's a lot of stories, there's a lot of history, but I'm telling you, it's a fun read, especially for me being able to go, damn, that's him, man. I verified it all.
Yeah.
40 years ago, among table games, there were three of them, blackjack, roulette, and craps. All casinos had all three. Slightly different rules, but basically all the same. Today, there are hundreds of different carnival games available. Each casino has its own selection of those. There are listeners on our show who know the rules to many of these games better than anyone employee in the casino does. How does that affect things?
I think it just shows you how difficult it is to master everything to be a really good casino manager. You know, there's people who go on the floor and then rise up and are just competent. And then there's people who are really good, and they're the ones who not only know the ins and outs of all the games, but they also know how to handle people. And one thing that came through in the interviews was that that's actually kind of rare. And there were some folks who actually preferred people who didn't know every detail of every game but could deal with people better. They thought they were a better asset just because they were a little bit more flexible and could handle different situations that came up. But it's, you know, and I'm going to kind of cross over with another thing that I'm sure everyone in this room will like to hear. So right now, my project now is I'm interviewing slot managers. And one of them actually said, you know, yeah, we do the math and everything for the promotions, but sometimes when we see certain people coming in and playing.
Didn't mention any names, did they?
They might have. They might have mentioned a couple names around this table. When we see certain people in there, we know that we've got a problem. We go back and look at our math, you know, just the fact that they're in there gambling under our promotion. So I think the good ones respect how intelligent the players can be and realize, like, yeah, there might be something going on here.
You know, in regard to the table games, I played a new table game a few months back that had come out, and it had just been put in. It was only, I think, in one casino here, and you know, we played it a couple of nights, and basically after a couple of nights they backed off, you know, one of the guys and his wife. And I mean, they didn't bar him or anything. They just said, look, you know, this is a brand new game and we don't really understand it. And you guys have just kind of won too much money. And so we just prefer you didn't play. And then the game was closed after that.
That doesn't say a lot about the vetting process at any level, does it?
Well, you would think. I mean, if I ran a casino, I would check those things out ahead of time. But that's just me.
Yeah,
but same with the promotion, right? Like, you can hire smart people who can tell you if your promotion is, you know, bad or not.
But however well you checked it out, you're not as good as Gross Gene.
Well, yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there's always the possibility for something to
you could just cut out the middleman and something you could hire Gross Gene.
Yeah.
That's in theory that might work. I don't know that James is interested in that.
Well, what Bob's saying is that you know, the players have a lot more time to think about these things, probably. The casino bosses have other things to do. And I was just at a meeting a week ago with some bosses, and I won't say from where, but they ran a promotion, and we got to talking about it, and it had to do with taxables. And the guy said, yeah, we vetted it every way we could. We vetted it right backwards and forwards for every video poker, you know, possibility we could think of, and no one thought about Keno. You know, it's just one of those things, you know.
Yeah.
Yep. Players 40 years ago seem more colorful than they are today. Now, one time, Richard, you said something about a guy named Benny the Bite. Do you remember anything about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I was reading the book, I was waiting for the characters to show up, and many of them did, but Benny didn't happen to make it. But yeah, there was a craps player named Benny the Bite who was thrown out of every casino in town because he was a degenerate craps player, and he would stand next to the stick man, and he'd get all his money on the layout, and when 7-out came, he would get so mad that he would just bite into the tricep of the stick man. And, you know, he got punched a number of times by dice dealers, but he got thrown out of everywhere in town. But so everybody knew him, and finally, I think it was the Stardust that started to let him come back in, and they said, okay, you can come in here and play, but you can't bite anybody, or we're really going to take it out on you if you do. So at that point, he started, instead of biting the dealer, he would, when the 7-out came, he would drop to his knees and bite into that leather railing around the, it's got to be one of the dirtiest things in the casino to put your mouth on. But
I love it.
Yeah, and I remember him coming into the Castaways when I was dealing there, and he asked for a comp. And the boss gave him a comp slip, which bosses used to be able to do, and he made it out under the name BT Bite. And Benny did not take kindly to that. He was very pissed off.
But
he took the free meal. You know?
everything was crazier back then, and everything was more colorful. I mean, I remember once I was at Gambler's Book Club, and somebody said, hey, whatever happened to so-and-so? The guy had died, right? And the other dude said, oh, he's 7'd out.
Yeah. Well, the other thing was, I mean, guys would show up with shopping bags full of cash, and nobody would ever think of asking them what their name was or for an ID. We had a guy at the Golden Nugget who would come in with a bag full of 20s and 10s and bet three hands of 500, which was the limit, in cash. And every time he got paid, he would rake the chips back to the table and bet more cash until he went through all the cash. And then he would go cash out all the chips. You know, I mean, can you imagine the feds would be here with a SWAT team if a guy tried to do that today?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the changes, is that thanks to the federal government cracking down all that other stuff, it seems like it's not as wide open as it used to be, not as fun in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the Shagra brothers were around back then, and
I know about Jimmy. I didn't know he had a brother.
Yeah, he had a brother. I can't remember his brother's name, but yeah, I mean, he would bet $100,000 a hand at the Horseshoe in like 1979 or something. I mean, that's a lot of money.
And he had big parties up in his suite at Caesars.
Yeah,
you know, I talked to people who would go to those parties, and they had, you know, the instead of peanuts in a jar, they had cocaine. You know, I mean, it was insane those days.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to let David Schwartz go. We've been talking about his book, Tales from the Pit, and he has another engagement. So we're going to say thank you, David. We're going to take a brief break for our sponsors, then we're coming back and talking more with Anthony Curtis. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In August, all the promotions will be for those who already get mailers. It's an unusual move for this casino, but this time they're decided to invest further in their most loyal customers. So if you don't have a mailer and don't know about it, it doesn't matter. You don't get anything. Next week's free video poker class, Wednesday, August 17th, is 8-5 bonus poker quick quads. Quick quads is a 6-coin per line game, where you get paid for hands containing a 3-of-a-kind and the other two cards add up to the rank of the trips. That is 8-8-8-5-3, or maybe 2-2-2-ace-ace. Or if you're a player, it's deuce-deuce-deuce-ace-ace. This this is one class only. It takes a while to explain the rudiments of quick quads, in which all quick quad games are similar, and then we superimpose that structure onto the game itself. Bonus poker is very, very similar to 9-6 jacks or better. And the game returns 99-5-5, which is pretty much the same as jacks or better, only it's a lot more fun. Class was held in Silverado Lounge, which is immediately in front of Don Vito's restaurant. At the Palms, from now until the end of August, they have drawings every Saturday night, 7:15. Winners share $10,000 each night. Every day, Monday through Friday, you can swipe to receive 20 free drawing tickets. PFP play for prizes, Monday through Friday. From now until the 26th, you earn Macy's gift cards. Prizes are redeemed at a rate of 0.2% for video poker players, up to $190 per day. You keep your points. The last week in August, Monday through Friday, in lieu of the play for prizes, they have mystery multipliers. Video poker players get at least 2x, and they can get 3x. Slot player numbers are quite a bit higher, multipliers. The limit on the multipliers is 80,000 points for the multipliers. Some people have a tough time figuring out what that means. If you get the double point multipliers, that means you can play 80,000 points and get it all multiplied. Most people don't play that much. If you get the triple point multiplier, you can play 40,000 points and get that tripled. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. Game of the week is 5-play wheel poker quick quads. This is 7 coins per line game. The wheel poker adds 1 extra coin, quick quads adds 1 extra coin, where you get a wheel spin every time you get a quad, 4 of a kind, or a quick quad. The wheel's values range between 50 and 2,000. The wheel is random, but not equally weighted. All right, let's go back and talk to Anthony Curtis.
Glad we got that Schwartz guy out of here. You know, I used to do a lot more, I used to get a lot more quotes in the newspapers and stuff before David Schwartz showed up. So, you know, less time on radio, less time in print, you know, this guy.
Yeah.
We forgot to bring up how much you hate him. We could call him back.
No. It's just me. Just me for the rest of the show. Let's go.
All right. A week or so ago on Michael Shackelford's Wizard of Vegas site, there was a thread about blackjack. I strongly disagreed with one of the posters, but I don't have the blackjack chops to end the argument, so to speak. Probably Richard and Anthony do, so let's talk about it. Assume you're given blackjack game, 8 decks, dealer hits soft 17, double after split, max 3 splits, no surrender. Player has $400 left at the table and makes a $100 bet. He gets dealt pair of 8s versus a 7. He splits, of course, and a third 8 is immediately dealt. He now has bet $300, and he resplits it. He now has bet $300, and he only has one additional $100 chip left. When he hits his first 8 again, he's dealt a deuce, making a 10. The question is then, do you double down with your last $100, or keep the Benjamin as ammunition in case you draw a 3 or another 8? Not having money to split another 8 is... would be a big loss. So, Richard, Anthony, speak up.
You want to go first?
Sure. What's the question? I don't. I mean,
basic, he only has $100 left.
I know. But assuming he's playing basic strategy or any credible card counting system based on basic strategy, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with how much money you have left. You know, that's a tournament play or something like this. Basic strategy or a card counting strategy dictates that you make X, Y, and Z plays based on what you have in front of you, not what might happen in the future or how much money you've got behind you. So, of course, you would double down if basic says to double down or if your system says to double down. I can't imagine Now watch Richard come in and disagree. I cannot imagine that you would wait.
So my, you know, my thought on this is, I mean, this is a very straightforward kind of math question, right? Like, what is the cost of not being able to double if on your next hand you get a three? So you could have had 11, an 11 double versus a 10 double, or what is the cost if you aren't going to be able to split the pair of eights, you know, the that rare time that you get the fourth eight, but just compare what does that cost versus what does it cost you to not double down on 10, right? But, I mean, just I didn't go look this up because I really don't care. I think it's the wrong sort of question to be asking because this kind of minutia is not where the money is. I would just, without hesitation, double the 10.
Right.
I mean, it is sort of the same thing when you get down to, let's say you're about to leave the casino and you have $100 left, and, you know, do you bet $100 because now you won't be able to double or split if you get it, right? And my thought would be to just not play the hand at all. But
yeah,
but,
or bet less. Why did you bet 100? Why did you bet a quarter of his bankroll right off the top?
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to worry about things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But sort of thinking, worrying about these kinds of things, I think are just the wrong approach to this is not where the money is. And to me, it's not really even an interesting intellectual question. You know,
when Peter Griffin was alive and I published his book and we were friends and we used to go out, and Peter used what was called a Gordon count. It was a very, very basic count because he kept side counts of everything else. I mean, he just kept side counts everywhere. Now, if you had a guy who was a computer that was doing something like that, and you were deep into the deck or deep into a single deck, and you knew that the deck was heavy with threes or something like that, sure, this could be a discussion. But I mean, to me, I agree with what you're saying, Richard. It's like, that shouldn't be the question. The question, you know, if you're going to ask anything there, is like, why did you bet so much if this is going to be a problem for you?
A quarter of your bankroll is not really that much. It's pretty rare that you get that a quarter, that betting a fourth of your bankroll, you have more than four bets out there.
But I would, yeah, but I'd be happy with that. I wouldn't worry about what would happen if I take it to a fifth bet. I would just get them all out good. I would get them out good. You know, certainly, yeah, there's a chance.
Get your money in when you have the advantage, and don't sweat it.
It's not that different, the 11 or a 10 against a 7. It's not that different.
Right.
I mean, it would have to be pretty severe.
Well, I mean, not being able to split a pair of 8s would be a big loss, but you have three of them already, and
there's
20. You know what I mean?
Well, it's 8 decks, so there's 32.
Yeah, I understand, but... So I think a much more interesting thing is, let's go back to talking about Peter Griffin, because I was fortunate enough to be able to deal to him while he was writing his book. And in the beginning, I had no idea who he was. And the place where I dealt, we had single deck strip rules, meaning stand on soft 17, no double after splits, no surrender back then, but on single deck. But
basically even money off the top.
Yeah. And he, at that time, he was using the high opt one with side counts of aces, deuces, sevens, eights, and the relationship of fives to sixes, because that was the only thing that was important about whether you hit a 16 against a 10 or not, was whether there were more fives in the deck than sixes. And he would keep an exact number of cards dealt, so he could calculate the true count exactly. And I would deal to him, and, you know, we would get down, and he'd say, you know, spread the deck. You should have 12 cards, and there'll be 1, 2, 1, 6, 2, 5s, you know, and he would just name them. And I would spread the deck, and, you know, and he was never wrong. I never caught
him. And the interesting thing about that, he used to love to do that as like sort of a party trick. But the interesting thing about that was he actually knew how to use it. You know, we used to talk about it. And he'd go, well, a lot of people can actually do this, but they don't know the relationships and they don't really know how to use it. And that's what was different. I mean, this guy would, his favorite play in the world was when he could hit a 17. I mean, you know, his count would tell him when it was proper to hit a 17, and he'd be absolutely gleeful when he could hit a 17. Because it usually worked out, not always, but he still loved it that it was right and that he could do it.
Sure. And that's not even that unusual play. 17 against an ace, right?
It's not, right. But yeah. he'd do it against eights.
Right.
You know, he used to love the 17 against an eight, man. That was his boy. Did he love that play?
Yeah.
You know, so it was, he was fun to play with. He really was.
The other thing was, I remember one time I was waiting for him, and he said, he goes, "Oh, you're dealing another hand?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You only have 8 cards left." I was like, "Well, you're the only player. Let's go." You know? So, yeah, I would deal all the way to the bottom for him.
The cool thing about Peter was you could talk to him about things like that because he did not play big money.
No,
he was a nickel player. That's
We had $2 tables, so he was spreading 2 to 8.
Yeah.
So,
For Peter, it was all about the theory. You know, hence the name of his book was The Theory of Blackjack.
Yeah.
And it was all about the theory and about the deal. I mean, his favorite game was Christmas time at Binion's when they paid 2 to 1 on blackjack. And literally, he and I would sit there and play every waking hour as long as we could, as long as they were dealing it. And I'll never forget, we would drink Heineken together. And when it was all over, I'd have to go into a 2-day siesta, you know, just to recover.
Yeah.
He was a great guy.
Yeah, he was. He was. Actually, another story I remember was I was dealing roulette one time, and he came over to talk to me while I was dealing roulette. And he had on this goofy fishing hat, and he was smoking a cigar for some reason. And we're talking, and I had some guy who was betting stacks of chips. Big, you know, we had 25-cent roulette, so guys would buy in for $20, and they'd want 25-cent chips and then bet stacks of them. Right. So I hit some number with this big stack on a split, and I count the chips down, and as I count them all down, I get to the end, and he goes, "Oh, 37 split, that's 629. And I go, "Yeah, that's what I get." Now the pit boss comes running over because he sees that this number got hit. And I see him grab a calculator off the desk. And I said, "You know, Scotty, it's 37 split. That's 629. And he punches it into the calculator. He goes, yeah, that's right." Yeah. So I never told Scotty that Peter was there helping me with the multiplication.
Oh, you got the credit for it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
right.
Terrific. Well, he loved everything like that. I mean, I was playing a keno tournament once in Reno, and he came up to meet me and to hang out. And I said, "I got to finish this." And I was working out the play. Keno had there was a distinct way to play keno tournaments, and we would use the back of the keno card to divide, make the division, you know, the calculations we had to make. So I was dividing something, and he started squealing, "Long division, long division," and jumping up and down and running around the casino screaming, "Someone's doing long division." He was so happy.
I had no idea we were going this direction. This has been fascinating. All right. Getting back to the show. Wow, this is more. It's great. All right. Nevada has legalized gambling on the Olympics, which are just about over. But the books are getting some bets on basketball, but not so many other games. So they're getting a lot less betting action than they thought they were. Do you have any thoughts on this, Anthony?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that if anyone's surprised by that, including them, they're crazy. I mean, you know, going in, most people, including most of the people who run the books and know what they're doing, assumed that there wouldn't be a lot of action on the Olympics for a couple of reasons. One being that people don't know the players as much. They know basketball players, but they don't really know, aside from Usain Bolt maybe, and, you know, a few
Michael Phelps,
a few of the big names. People want to bet on people they know and that they can get behind and they have a stake to. I think another problem is that cannot be underestimated is the television delay. I mean, people want to watch games they want to bet on games that they can watch in real time. And everything's being shown on TV 4 hours after it happened, you know, or later. So that makes a problem. You don't want to just make a bet and then try to avoid what happened all day long so you can watch it on TV or hear about it and not be able to see it unfold. Finally, the ones that hung lines were very, very running scared in terms of their limits. And people who did want to bet them, guys who do make bets on lots of different things, maybe they're not the action they wanted. But these players just laughed. Most of these places wouldn't take more than $100 on a bet. So that chases everybody away. So, you know, there are just a lot of factors against it going in.
And it's also a sporting event for non-sporting fans. These aren't really your sports fans. This is it. Right. Everybody watches the Olympics, not just other bets. All right. Maryland Live is suing the new MGM casino there for hiring their host and stealing their high roller list. Now, when I heard this, I was surprised. This has been happening for years. This is pretty much business as usual. Did you hear about this, Anthony? Why is this such a big deal?
I heard about it when you told me today we were going to talk about it. So, I don't know why it would be a big deal. A new location, a new jurisdiction, different ways of doing business. I mean, like you say, this has been going on forever. I've heard in the past of there being issues when it gets super blatant. Somebody actually steals a disc with names on it and things like that. You know, then that gets into regular theft. But if a guy's keeping his own book, as they call it, or his own sheet, he's going to go back to his old customers, just like stockbrokers do, and anybody else. I don't know. These new jurisdictions, they write their own regs, and maybe there's something in those regulations that say you can't do this. But to me, it's insane, and it sounds naive that anybody would get, worn out about it because it happens all the time.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't get it.
All right.
That was a great one.
You want to go back to talking about Peter Griffin?
I'd love to. There was this woman. She was convicted of stealing $500,000 from her employer in Greater Las Vegas. It's also been determined that she's a problem gambler. Apparently, there's a law that says if you can prove you're a problem gambler, then you can go to a treatment facility rather than prison. It strikes me as an advantage play.
Not a good one. Would it be worth it?
It does cut your downside.
Yeah. Yes, it cuts your downside, but yeah, I don't see it as an advantage play. I mean,
I've been saying for years and years that advantage play is now this used term, and it means something. You know, when it was originally coined, I've said this on the show many times. As far as I know, it came from Steve Forte, who used the term to describe everything where you can get an edge, from playing legal as can be, and just straight card counting, or a promotion that they just hand to you on a silver platter, to people who literally steal the money, walk in there and pull it out of the tray and run out with it. That's an advantage play by his original definition. But those kinds of plays on the far right of that spectrum really give the term a really bad name, and I would say this one would be right up at the top. That would be a pretty creepy play, whether you get away with it or not.
Yeah. I don't think we should be calling things like that advantage plays.
No, it's kind of changed. It's kind of changed over the years, and it means something different. But I mean, I've talked to certain players and people about certain things they do, and I say I don't consider that a justifiable play. I don't consider if somebody's doing coupons or use a. I went through it myself with our own member rewards book when we have gambling coupons. Before they had to take it through the booths, the Players Club booths, and people would take them down and get them counterfeited.
Yeah.
And they'd go, well, that's what you used to do. And I go, no, I didn't. Never counterfeited anything in my life. I never stole or counterfeited. And I said, to me, this is nonsense. And same thing here.
Yeah.
But you did, as did I, somewhat abuse the only one coupon per person fine print on these things.
Did you? Oh,
of course. Of course. I supported myself. And when I first moved here, it was like $200 a week on couponomy.
There's a distinction, and I will say that I did that too when I was playing. That's what these guys come in, and I'll bring them into this very room where we're having this, this interview right now, and I'll say, that's not going to fly here. And they'll say, what a hypocrite you are. You did it yourself. And I'll go, wait a minute, just like I just said. But there is a distinction when they're laying out there like they used to do. They would lay out there in gigantic piles and would say one per person per day. And, I mean, they're almost daring you, to see if you can play more than one. And sure, I played more than one too, and everybody did. But I didn't go and steal someone else's book or take it to a copy center and get them copied. I think that's a big difference. I really do.
Yeah, I see the distinction. I do.
Let's talk football. Oakland Raiders still might move to Las Vegas. Nothing has been approved yet, but locally folks are taking it pretty seriously and very optimistically. There's bunches of possible sites to build the stadium, each with pluses and minuses. Maybe the one in first place now is a golf course owned by Billy Walters.
He could probably use the cash.
I'll bet he could. This is on Las Vegas Boulevard, just south of Mandalay Bay, just west of McCarran Airport. What do you think is going to happen, Anthony?
Well, I think that Billy Walters is going to press any advantage he possibly can. If I were the one wanting him to, you know, give something up to me, I would make sure that the person I got to negotiate with him was somebody that knew him well and that he respected and wasn't going to, you know, that might soften him a little bit. However, you know, I would try to ingratiate myself to him before I, you know, tried to make it happen. But I don't think he has as big an edge as some people might think, because I know there are at least 7 or 8 different options here and some pretty good options. And I don't think anybody's going to really take it up the rear end here just because they want specifically that place. I think they'd be willing to walk.
Also, I thought there was a problem with that place and because of the airport.
I think that's pending, and I think it's considered that it's going to be something they can get around pretty good. I think that they really do want the Bally High. That's the Bally High Golf Course site. I think they do want that, and it'll be interesting to see what Billy does. I mean, you know, there's a point of diminishing returns for, you know, this is deal-making. This isn't gambling. This is deal-making, and he's very, very good at that. And there's a point where, you know, someone says, forget it. I'm going somewhere else. Your price is too high, and he's going to have to do that expertly as he always has. My guess, if it's going to happen, and I don't think any of this is going to happen for a long time, by the way, but my guess is that they'll probably be able to make a deal with him, because I think he'd be smart enough to say, yeah, I'm going to make a profit, and I'm not going to be so stingy or so tight that someone else is going to make that profit.
Yeah. Plus, my understanding is that the golf course isn't doing that well, so...
I don't think the golf course is doing well, and he doesn't own it either, you know, so it's not that kind of thing. They just have to buy him out of a lease. That, you know, that land is owned by the county or the city, or I think the county. Mm. So,
but it's like a so-many-year lease that you would have to also negotiate with the county to get a longer lease once you got his share of it.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't want to...
Well, but if you're building a football stadium, you have to make a deal with the county anyway. I mean, that's part of the...
I think the key to this is that how well is the course doing? And like Richard just said, I don't think the course is doing real well. So he's if it's doing poorly, I would guess he's doing flip-flops going, hooray, you know, I'm going to get off this thing. And if that's the case, then they're going to get a deal done. I just don't think, I think there's too many other pieces to this. You know, there's too many other moving parts. Look how long it took to get hockey. And some people might say because hockey broke the ice, you know, it's going to be an easier ride. I don't think so. I think that the NFL is much more complicated than the NHL, and I think it's going to be a long ways coming, a couple of years.
A couple of years is not really a long time.
Well, people are acting, but the way people are acting, like, we can't wait. You know, next year we got the Raiders, and I'll wait. You know.
But happening by 2020, you wouldn't be really amazed.
That's a pretty good line. It's a pretty good number. Pretty good over under there.
All right. GamblingWithAnEdge.com has been going on now for about a month. It opened up beta wise, I think sometime in late June. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty cool. Anthony, you your people started it. Are you happy with it? What's your take on it?
Yeah, I'm real happy with it. You know, every time somebody comes on a radio show or the news and they talk about their thing, it's always great, right? You never hear bad, even when you know it's bad. And so I don't want to sound like that, but I've been trying to get a blog started for years, you know, individual blogs with friends of mine and people I know in the business and some really great guys, and we just could never do it. I mean, really, really good guys. And I would get so defeated by it. I was like, you know, they got such great information, but they just couldn't maintain it because it wasn't their day job. And putting all these people together has kept a real steady flow of information, and we're looking at the response to it. And a lot of people are still not getting in and participating in the comments, but that doesn't matter because we're seeing the eyes going to it and people are reading it. The media is coming to me and talking to me about it. And we're just getting, we haven't even done a media push yet. We haven't even let people know, so it's just word of mouth. And we've got other elements that we're going to integrate into it, too, that are still on the way. So it's, for a long time, I've been saying I only had one good idea in my life, and that was the Las Vegas Advisor. This is seeming like a good idea. I don't know if it's that good, but it's seeming pretty good so far.
All right. Are you allowed to give us any clue as to what those new features are going to be? Are they?
Yeah, new bloggers. I mean, the neat thing about this is the people that have come out of the woodwork, guys that I've known for a long time or guys that I've have lost contact with that are coming to me and saying, I could write about this and I could write about that. And they're coming up with ideas that I hadn't even thought of. One of them is, I mentioned the first time when it was coming out, we've got a guy that wants to blog on Advantage Play with credit cards. I think it's great. Uh-huh. And we haven't started it yet because it's a real tough, you know, we need to monetize this thing for it to work. You know, I need to be able to send these guys who are doing it a check every once in a while and say, hey, thanks a lot, you know, and you can't just do this stuff for free. So we need to find a way to monetize it. We're not going to make the customer pay to listen. You know, that's just not going to work. So we need to do it with ads, and we need to do it with affiliate deals, with poker sites and things like that. We think we can do it quite well with credit cards, but that's a tough nut to crack. So we've been holding this guy back a little bit, going, not yet, not yet, but pretty soon we will. And I think that's going to be a pretty good element of it. But just some of the guys that come to me and talked about Advantage Play, you'll like this, Bob, you know, Advantage Play for married people. And, like, what are all the things you have to balance? And, you know, the ups and downs of how do you treat it when you've got a spouse who doesn't quite understand who's halfway into it, and various things like that. Even like Tales from the Pit, when you take Schwartz's book, you know, a guy like Ron Sacavino used to write his own newsletter about being, you know, in the inside. I've had, not Ron, because, you know, Ron's kind of retired, I'm going to talk to him about it, but I've had casino executives come to me, and they're reading it, and they want to write, you know, from the inside. They want to blog. I think it's cool. You get them all together in one forum.
You know, T. Dane was a guy who was working in surveillance who had a blog for a short period of time. It'd be great to get a surveillance guy to write a blog.
I agree. Those of you who are out there listening who have something to say, here's the great thing about it. You don't have to commit to any number of blogs. I mean, we've got one guy who's put up only two blogs. We've got another guy who's put up about nine already. I think Bill Ordine on Daily Fantasy Sports has put up about nine. That's a good one. The Daily Fantasy Sports one's a good one. You know, I mean, that's about to heat up again. And he's putting up strategies, and he's putting up stuff that's going on in the industry and all. But the cool thing is, I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter. If you don't have anything to say, you know, I've got a guy like Frank B., who puts up some really great stuff on sports betting, but he wants to make it a thesis every time he does it, you know? And I said, you don't have to do that. I said, you can go and write two paragraphs about something you just saw. And some of the guys are starting to get on to that, and that's what makes it good. So anybody with an idea, come and see me. We're going to make sure you got the goods. We're not going to let – I've turned down a lot of people so far. No, sorry, I can't quite use what you're doing right now. But if you've got something good to blog about, come do it. And, you know, we'll put you in as a guest blogger. You only have to do one or two. You see how it goes.
Yeah, my normal Tuesday column, which is fitting into this blog format, has typically been 800 to 1,000 words. But I finally realized that sometimes if whatever I want to say can go into 250 words, well, that'll work for Anthony. And I'm going, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, because if you've got something important to say and you can say it in 250, that's terrific. A lot of people will be put off by something that's very long. They go, I don't have time to read that right now. I'm going to come back to it later. And they never do. But they see it's quick, and they'll do a quick hitter. As long as it's got the goods. And I will say that really of all the blogging that's been done, the response to your column, which is now /blog, has been as good as any, with people coming in and commenting. And it's doing exactly what we envisioned that it might do.
Very good. Thank you, Anthony Curtis. Now, Richard, we have new music on our show. How did that happen? There's been people like the old music. Are we going to go back to the old music, or what's the deal here?
You know, the comments I get, people like the old music, but they didn't like the old introduction. Although a lot of people said, oh, it's exactly 1 minute, so I know how to fast forward through it very quickly, you know. So the problem was I never got a clean copy of that intro from the old radio station. So what I had just came to a dead stop, and I just, I thought the intro was way too long, and it just didn't sound good. And so I was looking around for something, and so I just came up with a piece of music that was free, that YouTube would not shut me down, you know, that was short. I mean, I can look around for other pieces or whatever, but, you know. Or we could just go without music. We'll just, you know, start with the...
No, you need music. I haven't heard it yet. I'm waiting. I'm waiting.
Yeah, so...
Who is it?
I don't know. It's just
It's not a known song?
No, it's not a known song.
It's not Go Down Gambling by Blood, Sweat, and Tears or something like that?
No, you got to have the rights to that stuff. And how we got
money
before, I don't know how they did. Well, they were a radio station and they paid for it, I guess. But anyway, that's the story on the music. And people are happy because it's short, so the show starts quicker.
And people still can get, in addition to the Gambling with an Edge, they can still get in touch with us the normal way. Is that correct?
Yep. You can email us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or put them on the Facebook page, facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can get the show delivered to you automatically every week. You can sign up to do that at gamblingwithanedge.com or iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube. And for an archive of every old episode, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
And we're still wanting to get conversations about the shows up on gamblingwithanedge.com. I mean, what we've got so far is, hey, guys, good show, really liked it. We would love for people to disagree or say you're full of it or, you know, I got a better idea or, you know, embellish or whatever. That would be terrific.
To get the discussion started, yep.
Very good. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Anthony. David is gone, but thank you, David. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.